briefly explain what they did. But then we're going on to the judiciary branch. So these points real simple. The system that we have was not created by our founding fathers, but rather it came from England, and it dates back 1,000 years. Basically, it involves judges making law with their rulings. So they have a case in front of them, they have two parties, situation happens. So what they try doing is they try making a determination that establishes a rule that can be applied to that same circumstance the next time it comes before them. So the example I usually use is if I was to walk up and punch you in the face in 1000 AD, essentially we would get the same outcome if I did that in 2026, because under the law it's called a battery. The official phrase of judges today basing their decisions on decisions in the past is stare decisis, which means to stand on what's decided. So our judges follow the rules made by their predecessors. In America, we still have that, but we also have our court systems. So we have the federal court system, we have the state court systems. But generally, stare decisis also applies today when if the high court makes a decision, all of the lower courts must follow it. Even if the lower courts disagree, doesn't matter. If the Supreme Court of the United States says this is the law, everyone must apply. And that is true in most courts. If the Supreme Court says something, it may apply in Massachusetts. So that means the Massachusetts courts have to apply. The only distinction is if it's not based on the Supreme Court decision, usually based on the U.S. Constitution. Well, not everything in the U.S. Constitution applies to what happens in Massachusetts. So, 2-minute intro of all that.
Yeah, I mean, some of that I've already gotten from criminal justice.
Yeah, so. Okay. Where do you look? Where do the courts look when they're going to impose laws? You start off with the Constitution. So federal courts generally start with the U.S. Constitution, Massachusetts courts look at the Massachusetts Constitution. New York Constitution, etc. They also look to common law. This is law that, again, that's judge-made. And the intent was to apply it universally. That's why it's called common law. So it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter when it happened. You're going to have a common decision that applies to everything. Case law, well, sometimes there are cases that are real particular, that have interesting nuances. Well, sometimes the court carves out a law that ends up being procedural. So think of Miranda v. Arizona. You know, that's a procedural rule. That's not necessarily a constitutional rule. That is, I'm sure as you know, that if you go into custody, you know, the moment the police decide they're going to take you into custody, they have to tell you, you have the right to remain silent, anything you say can't be used against you, blah, blah, blah. Then, of course, statutes. You know, so if the legislature makes a statute, then the courts have to look to that as well. But the challenge with applying statutes is that laws are vague, and they're intentionally meant to be vague. So how do you apply a vague law to a particular circumstance? Well, the sad part is in the last 40 or 50 years, both Congress and the state legislatures intentionally make the laws vague. Because if they try getting particular, it's going to cause lots of political battles, which could cause some of them to lose office. So they make it as vague as possible and basically let the courts figure it out. Which, of course, is challenging. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Oh, good. Having fun in all the traffic.
Yeah. So
good. Absolutely. So, I was just doing a review because she wasn't here on the last class. So. But you were here, so you got all that. But the tape is rolling, so I'm just going to keep going. And I know we get people who come in late, but, of course, that means everyone can always go back to the recordings and listen to what they missed. All right. Equal justice under the law. I should have just whizzed it out on Tuesday, but we ran out of time. This is the most important four words when you think of our court systems. Equal justice under law. These four words are literally carved into the edifice above the U.S. Supreme Court building. Equal justice under law. What this means is simple. Neither the United States government nor any state can derive persons or classes of persons of equal and impartial justice. Under the law. It's not part, it's not some, it's the whole mindset. So what does that mean? Justice is a word that's often misused intentionally by people with political intentions. Justice does not mean you get what you want. That's not justice. Justice does not mean people need to put you on a pedestal. That's not justice. Justice is the right to make your case. Whether you win or you lose, that's not relevant to justice. So, if you believed someone has harmed you, you have the same rights when you go into a courtroom as the person who you alleged did the harm. Both people will have their day in court. Both people will have the ability to make their case. They can present their evidence. They can present their witnesses. And then once they present their case, the court will apply the law to that particular circumstance. So what does that mean? Well, there's two parties that go in a courtroom. Someone's going to win and someone's going to lose. So long as the winner wins because that's what the law says, that's justice. And that also applies to the person who loses. So long as the loss is not because of bias or discrimination or corruption or manipulation, that's still justice. The law says you must lose, you lose. Fairness does not weigh in the eyes of the court. I heard that from my kids the moment they were like 2 or 3. It's not fair. Life's not fair. I'm assuming you know what Lady Justice looks like. Lady Justice, woman, flowing gown, with her eyes covered by a blindfold. Again, Lady Justice is not supposed to look at who's before her. She's supposed to listen. Lady Justice has the scales. Both sides put their evidence in the scales, and whichever way the scales tilt, that's justice. But she also wields a sword. So that way the loser will be struck down. Because if you do something illegal, and this is the hardest thing for young people to get in their heads, you don't have a right to commit a crime. You do not have a right to commit a crime. If the government says something is illegal, it's against the law. And if you do that, you should be punished in a fair system. Questions? So how does the system work? Well, the funny thing is, and I don't even know if it's funny necessarily, but I am a lawyer, as I may have said, but I do not litigate. So I do not, I don't go to court. I'm a paper pusher because I don't have time to go to court because I teach. But I have done some courtroom work, and I can tell you, when you go to court, it's not a game. It is a contest. It is adversarial. You have two sides that are literally battling against one another. That's why whenever you see a court name, court case name, it is Jones versus Stevens. Because justice requires a winner and a loser. The goal is to destroy your enemy. Because the person on the other side of the bench is, or the other side of the tables, is your enemy. If there was not some type of dispute, conflict, between the two parties, you would not be in court. Party A wants something from Party B. Party B wants something from Party A. And only one is going to get that. Now, of course, as you know, in criminal cases, by right, in civil cases, by request, the parties do have a right to go before a jury. What's a jury? What is a jury? It's not a hard question. It's not a hard, really. Not a hard question.
I was
going to
say, like, the people decide.
Yeah. And who are the people?
They're chosen.
From where? Citizens. In the community. The idea of the jury system is, again, something we inherited from England. If something happens in a village, the people who you want to terminate what happens as a result of that event are the villagers. Because if you live in a community, you have a right to determine what's right and what's wrong. Do you want somebody who is causing violence to their neighbors? No, but you also don't want a mob of people, or a pogrom, you know, going and basically going to that person's house with torches and pitchforks and killing them. You know, that's worse. So the English determined the best way to ensure justice is to allow the people to decide who wins, who loses. In our modern society, anyone registered to vote in Massachusetts, your name goes into a database, and every 3 years, you could get called for jury duty. So if you get called to jury duty, you get a summons today, you might not get called until 2029. Usually it's more than that. I know people that haven't gotten called to jury duty in like 20 years. I know some people who get it like seeming like every 3 years, like clockwork. But ultimately, the idea is you bring people in, you try to get a snapshot of the community. You know, you want, generally speaking, the perfect jury, you know, has men and women in it. You know, it doesn't have to be 10 women to 2 guys, but it doesn't necessarily have to be 6 and 6. It could be 7 and 5, you know, just to balance. You want a snapshot of the average man or woman. So you want like a teacher, you want like a plumber, you want like a business guy. You know, you just want a representation of the community. They have the evidence presented to them. They are instructed by the judge on the law, and it's the jury's decision to determine who wins, who loses. Now, of course, the judge is the ringleader. The job of the judge is to preside over the courtroom to make sure that the law, be it procedural, so how the court's supposed to operate, or substantive, murder, arson, rape, embezzlement, fraud, you know, that the law is properly adhered to. And at the end of the day, depending upon the jury's decision, it's up to the judge to impose the punishment. What type of outcomes that could be made by the jury? Someone is found guilty, if it's a criminal case, so the jury believes they did what they were accused of doing. Or they are acquitted, meaning the jury decided, no, they did not do what they were accused of doing. Yes?
I guess this is just more of your opinion, but I don't know. I think like sometimes with the jury, like I feel like it can go wrong. Like I think of the cases I think of the most, I think of like OJ and like maybe the Diddy case, like where they were both like not found guilty, even though like all the evidence was like right there.
I agree with you 100%. So one of my favorite professors in law school basically said, and I'll remember, there's a couple of quotes that I remember from some of my professors. Some of my professors were date rats. But my criminal law professor said, on like the first day of class, a jury is your best friend and your worst enemy. Because it's filled with rocket scientists and morons. If you think about it, the greatest benefit of a jury is, in a perfect world, you have, like I said, that snapshot, that perfect representation. But the reality is that every man and woman that sits in a jury, they all have their own opinions. They all have their own internal biases. You know, there are things they like, there are things they don't. And sometimes those biases are uncontrollable. So, in the case of O.J. Simpson, the jury had, and again, I'm not trying to be controversial, I'm just trying to be as neutral as I can, the jury intentionally was overfilled with African Americans and women. That was the greatest group. I think there was five. Why did the lawyers for the defense try to get that? Well, you have 12 jurors, and if you have five of them that are African American, well, you can kind of play the race card, because again, human beings are pro or con when they see themselves in other people, or they see something different. And then you have women, who have a tendency to be a little more emotional as opposed to rational. So what did they do? O.J. Simpson, famous athlete, movie star. He did commercials. There wasn't a human being alive in the United States when it all went down that did not know O.J. Simpson. And how did they convince it? With some of one of the most brilliant tactics of lawyering that's textbook, it's studied. The key thing that changed the opinions of the juries was the glove, the Isotona gloves. The gloves, leather, custom made, not something you could get off the shelf, because O.J. Simpson had big hands. But the gloves had been soaked in blood. What happens to leather when it gets wet? It shrinks. Two, O.J. Simpson had arthritis from the years of playing football. Well, when you have arthritis, you take pills, and those pills are anti-inflammatory pills. When you have arthritis, your fingers swell and get bigger. You take the medication, they shrink. The lawyers told him to stop taking his arthritis pills. Then, his attorneys knew, could not touch the gloves because you could contaminate the evidence. So the only way you can handle evidence is you put on latex gloves. So imagine a glove that was custom made to his hand when he takes his pills, soaked in blood, no pills, latex glove on. Go ahead, put it on in the courtroom. And then what did his attorney say? If the glove don't fit, you must acquit. Brilliant lawyering. Did he murder his wife and her lover? There is no doubt in my mind. There is no way anyone else could have done it. They had the shoes, they had the gloves, they had the murder weapon, they had it all. But the cops screwed it up, thinking it was going to be a slam dunk, and they didn't bring their A game. They just got out-lawyered. So yes, a murderer literally walked. But here's the thing. If you go back and you read the words of our founding fathers, Jefferson and Adams and all of the other founders were lawyers, you'll find a common thread. They would rather have a system where somebody who is guilty walks than have someone who is innocent go to jail. Any other questions? All right. So we know it's going to be two parties, and they're going to be duking it out, and one's going to try winning, and the other's going to try not to lose, and the jury makes the decision, and the judge applies the law. Well, who could end up in court? Who can sue, and who can be sued? Does anybody know? Who can sue, or who can be sued? Can you be sued, Abby? No, not necessarily. People will sue anybody for any reason. If you're going to be... Everyone. Every human being can be sued. Every human being can be sued. What about someone who's dead? Can they sue or be sued?
Yes.
Yes, how? Will they dig them up, bring them in the coffin?
I just think of like family cases where like the person dies and then like they try to keep their money and stuff and then they sue.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily the dead person, but it's the estate of the dead person. So your imprint is your estate. The items you own, the money you have, all of your accounts, that estate is the residual of you after you die. That estate does have rights under the law. And if someone wrongs you, your estate has the ability to sue. Or if you wrong somebody, someone could go after your estate. So even death doesn't allow you to escape in some circumstances. What about businesses? Can businesses sue? Or be sued? Yeah. Under our legal system, businesses, corporations, are treated as legal entities. They have rights in a courtroom. What about a dog? Can a dog sue or be sued? The dog can't sue, but you could sue the owner. So if you have a dog and it bites somebody, you are going to go to court. Because it's your property and you're responsible for your property. What about a child? Can you sue a child? You can sue a child, but it's up to their guardians or their parents. You know, that ultimately gonna self-counsel. What about the desk? The desk you're sitting in. Can you sue the desk you're sitting in? You can't sue the desk, but you can sue the manufacturer. Yeah, good. So, this is very broad-ended, obviously. All right, if it is a civil case, so you're suing someone because you're alleging they caused you some type of harm and you're seeking compensation in the form of money damages. You, if you are the person suing, you are the plaintiff. And the person you are suing is commonly referred to as the defendant. They have to defend themselves from your claim. Oh, if it's a criminal case, I don't have that on there and I don't know why. If it's a criminal case, it's going to be the state or the government. The state or the U.S. government that's going to bring the claim. And the person who's accused of the crime is the defendant. So if you see Massachusetts v. Jones, that's a criminal case, and Massachusetts is trying to prosecute Jones for some crime. I don't know why that's not there, but it should be there. All right. Now, in order to sue, you have to meet five criteria. In order to get into a courtroom and have a jury decide your case, you have to meet five criteria. And that's how it's going to be on the exam. Criteria to sue. The first criteria is standing. Standing. In order to sue someone, the plaintiff has to be able to show two things. They have to show they were harmed, and they have to identify who did it with reasonable specificity. You have to be able to show that you are harmed and who did it. So, to Abby's point that she made earlier, you can be sued because someone could make a claim you did something against them, and all they got to do is name you. That's enough to get the process rolling. We are a very litigious society. People will sue anybody at a drop of a hat, which makes life challenging. And you always have to be on your guard and be mindful of that. I've been sued twice. And I was sued twice. Actually, no, I was sued three times. I was sued twice for doing my job exactly as the rules say I was supposed to do my job. And the other time I was sued because I didn't like the job that someone else did. So I get sued because of it. Bizarre. It's really bizarre. The good news is that I didn't lose any of them. All right. also, the second criteria to sue, plaintiff must have standing. They have to identify the what and the who, but the what must be justiciable. The what the plaintiff is alleging that the defendant did to them, that issue has to be justiciable. Meaning, the court must be able to do something about it. The law must provide a remedy. So, for example, if I rear-end your car, the law provides a whole bunch of possible remedies. The court could force me to repair your car. The court could force me to pay for your rental car that you need to go to work while your car is off the road. If you were injured, the court could force me to pay your medical bills. If you're going to have a long-term or lifelong injury, the court could impose a requirement that I pay you pain and suffering. There's a whole bunch of things that the law allows the courts could do from a rear-ending accident with two auto vehicles. But you know what the court cannot do? If you get sad because someone said something that you were offended by, or they were mean, you're not going to have a day in court. There's nothing in the law that protects you from other people's words, in most instances. When I was a kid, we learned an old nursery rhyme. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. If someone says something that you think is mean or hurtful or offensive, there is no remedy in the law. Now, if they are threatening words, like, I'm gonna kill you, that's a different situation. But for those things that most people get all hot and flustered about, my politics are different than yours. Some people lose their absolute mind about that. There's nothing in the law that the court can do. The court does not have the authority to give you a tissue. So if you try bringing an issue that is not justiciable, you will not enter the courtroom. Three. The issue not only must be justiciable, but the issue must be right. Like a nice piece of fruit. We all know that you could go to a store in the summertime and pick up a peach, or a banana, or a mango, or guava, kiwi. And sometimes those items of fruit get to the grocery store before they are ready to eat. So you have to leave them out on the counter for a few extra days. Because if you try eating them too early, you might get sick. Have any of you tried eating an unripened peach? It's like wicked hard and it's bitter and it's just like, ugh! I suppose if you had nothing else to eat, you'd stomach it, but... rightness means that the harm that you are alleging is real. And it has happened or will happen in the near future. Ripeness. The harm is real and it has happened or will happen in the near future. It, however, cannot be imaginary. So, you have a horrible nightmare in which Lamanic is making a promise to haunt you for the rest of your life. You wake up, you're freaked out. You go to the court, you file your claim. You are afraid of your life. You are going to be haunted. At some point, someone will ask you, well, when did it happen? Where did it happen? And you're going to say, in my dream. The court's going to say, sorry. That's not real harm. That's imagination. You know that. At the same time, the issue cannot be moot. Moot generally refers to expired. You have a limited window to file a claim. Many of the justiciable issues are limited by what's referred to as a statute of limitations. The law literally says how much time you have from the point you're harmed to file your claim. So, for example, if you do get into a fender bender, under the laws of Massachusetts, you have 3 years to file your claim against the driver from the point of the accident. If you try going to the courtroom, 3 years and 1 day, it's too late. The window is closed. That issue is now moot. Another way to think of mootness is like pregnancy. While the baby is in the belly, the issue is ripe. There is a pregnancy. But the moment the baby, that pregnancy has ceased to be. It can never happen again. There may be other pregnancies, but not that one. It's over, it's done, it's moot. And last but not least, this is where we're going to spend most of our unit on the courts, is venue. As we are going to see, there are different courts. We don't have a court. We have courts. We have multiple courts in the federal system, and we have multiple courts in the different state systems. And if you try filing your claim in the wrong court, you will not get a trial. So, for instance, let's say you slipped and fell in Walmart because water was on the ground and no one in the store, in a timely manner, put out the caution little yellow thing. Well, you would file in Massachusetts depending upon what you are alleging. If your claim is less than $25,000, you're going to file in the district court. If it's more than $25,000, you're going to file in the superior court. But if you try filing that slip and fall claim, say, in the probate court or the land court, those are the wrong venues. You will be kicked out. And do you want to know the amazing thing? You will not get your money back. Because in order to file, you have to file a filing fee. If you file your claim in the wrong court, you don't get that money back. And by the way, if you hired a lawyer to do the filing for you and they file it in the wrong claim, you will call the Massachusetts Bar Association and you will file a complaint about that lawyer. Because if a lawyer doesn't file your claim in the right court, they should be disbarred. Just saying.
So, if on the exam I was to ask you, what are the five basic criteria to sue somebody? Standing, justiciability, ripeness, not moot, and proper venue. Questions? All right. Now,
the most complicated aspect of venue is that we have two, count them, two tiered systems.
That should be plural. We have two tiered systems. Why two? Simple. We have state court systems, and we have, and the federal court systems. Sorry, I have three different versions of this particular slide. Some have graphics. I don't think this one does.
Oh, maybe I should use the graphic one. I can do the graphic one.
Oh, wait, no, I don't have it with me. All right, never mind. All right, so we'll stick with the boring text one because this actually lines up with your outlines. All right.
Now, generally speaking, every single state, all 50 states, have the same basic structure. But they differ in some areas.
Sorry, I'm just lost. Hold on. Am I even using the right one? Am I using an old one? Oh, all right. I see what I did. All right.
We'll come back. I'll give you the details for this. Most state court systems, it's like a pyramid. Down at the bottom, that's where all the trial courts happen. Trial courts, that's the bottom level. So that's where you will take your evidence, your claim. You might appear before a judge. In a jury, you'll get your outcome, justice. Then above the trial courts is an appeals court or appeals courts. As we will see, you have a right to a trial, but you do not have a right to an appeal. If you get an outcome in the trial that you do not like, that's not grounds for an appeal. You can only get an appeal, which is another set of judges looking at what happened, if there was a mistake made during the trial, if there was some type of error. And then above the appeals court is the top court. In the federal system, it's called the Supreme Court of the United States. But every single state has a different name for their top court. For instance, in New York State, their highest court is called the New York Court of Appeals. In Massachusetts, our top court is called the SJC, Supreme Judicial Court.
If you make it up to the top court, there's no one else to go to. That's the top of the mountain. There is no way to appeal a top court decision.
The judges who sit on the court benches.
Interestingly enough, in the state courts, most are not appointed for life. four states, you can be a judge if you get the appointment. So there's no qualifications. You don't have to be a lawyer. You don't have to go to law school. If you get appointed to be a judge, you could be a judge. 23 states have judges appointed based on some type of merit system.
So I think we're going to see it when I start talking about Massachusetts specifically. In order to be a judge in Massachusetts, you have to go to an accredited law school. You have had to have passed the Massachusetts bar exam, and you have to be a member of the Massachusetts Bar Association.
I could be a judge. None of you at this point in your lives could, though.
Now, interestingly enough, there are 15 states that elect their judges.
But they're nonpartisan.
So they're not, they don't run as a Democrat, they don't run as a Republican.
Now, what are the qualifications to run in those elections? They vary from state to state, but most of them don't have necessarily the specific qualifications as the merit-based states. So if you are popular enough to win an election, you could go to one of those states and run, and you might be able to become a judge. Interestingly enough, 8 states actually have partisan elections. So judges run as Democrats or Republicans. And we all know how partisan politics are.
Wisconsin is one of the states that recently had a significant partisan election for a judgeship on their high court. Previously, I think their high court has 7 members, and this was the one election where there was only one up. The other years there are 2. Originally, it was like 4 Republicans and 3 Democrats.
Well, the Democrat Party nationally pumped in millions and millions and millions of dollars, and then the Republican Party nationally pumped in millions and millions of dollars. It was one of the most expensive judicial elections in history. And in the end, the Democrat ended up winning. And they flipped the bench.
Why does that matter, though? Like, if you're a judge, doesn't that take the whole point away?
If you are going to be, it does. It is a big matter. Because you want a judge to be impartial.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, I feel like that should be a thing. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah, it's crazy. Some of the races are crazy. And so what does that mean? Well, if a Democrat is the judge in your courtroom, most people might sit back and think, if I'm a Republican, does that mean I'm not going to get a fair shake? And that, you know, shatters the faith in the impartiality of the court system. Yeah, I don't know why states do it.
Is that like written anywhere?
Every single state has their own laws. So I guess the best thing to do is just, if you're going to commit a crime, know what state you're in. Or better yet, just don't. All right. Now, 47 states, judges have terms.
47 states, the judges have terms.
And most of the judicial terms are somewhere between 6 and 10 years.
Of those 47 states, I think
15 have term limits. So if you serve as a judge, you only can serve, I think, 2 of the states that have 10-year terms, judges can only serve 1 term.
But many of the states that have eight, I've seen, or six, you know, they can serve two terms. One of them has three terms.
The rest don't. So they theoretically could keep running until they die.
The only exception is
Massachusetts, Connecticut,
and Rhode Island. Those judges in all those states are appointed,
and they do not have terms. So meaning, once they are on the bench, it is technically for life. That's called good behavior tenure. Questions? All right, now let's see where I'm going to take myself. All right, jurisdictions.
Jurisdictions. Let's separate
the state from the federal.
In the federal court tier, in order to have a case heard in federal courts, there are two areas of jurisdictional authority. By the way, jurisdiction is the area that the court can control, has authority over. In the federal court system, there are two areas. The first area involves what's referred to as federal questions. Federal questions. Federal questions are easy. A federal question is an issue that has come up under either the U.S. Constitution or a United States statute, something under the U.S. Code, United States law, or a treaty that was the United States' part. Federal questions. U.S. Constitution, U.S. law, U.S. treaty. Example. Marathon bomber. Bombers. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. Tamerlan Tsarnaev. I think that was his older brother. They perpetrated a horrific crime on Marathon Day, in which they got some pressure cookers and they filled them with nails and glass and other chunks of metal, detonated them right at the end of the Boston Marathon. Killed four people. Like there was a runner, there was a kid, and there was other two other people that were standing on the sidewalk. That is a homicide. They murdered people. The older brother ended up running himself over. He fell out of a car he was driving, and somehow, when he fell out of the car, his head undid on the ground and the back wheel went over. I don't know how physically it happened, but it happened. The younger brother managed to get out of the car. He hit himself in a boat. Until the Boston police, along with state police and SWAT teams, they used heat-seeking drones and they found him hiding in the boat. They arrest him. Massachusetts could have tried him under Massachusetts law because he committed a murder, which is illegal under Massachusetts law. But the problem is, in Massachusetts, we do not allow the death penalty. No matter what someone does, the Massachusetts, the SJC, decided back in the late 70s, there is no crime that equals the death penalty. Well, this bastard killed four innocent people, including a child. So the governor, at the time, decided to allow the federal government to handle it. Because under the federal law, you cannot be convicted for murder. Murder is not a federal crime. But you know what is? Terrorism. So they would try, he was tried as a terrorist. And the difference between the federal government and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is the United States government does have the death penalty. So, one incident involved both sets of laws, but the decision was made to let the U.S. government handle it. Now, by the way, he also could have been tried under Massachusetts law. But if the goal is to kill him, why have him get convicted for guilt in the U.S. system, punishment of death, and then waste the taxpayers' money in Massachusetts, where the most he could get is life? All right, the other area, I've only had two students. I've been teaching this section for almost 30 years. I only had two students who've gotten this one right. And you can't answer because you heard this in U.S. government. Diversity of citizenship is the other area that federal courts have jurisdiction over. Anyone want to take a crack at it? What is it meant by diversity of citizenship? No one wants to take a guess? It has nothing to do with diversity. Like DEI. Nothing to do with that. When the United States government was, when the United States was formed, we were not a country. Technically, we still are not a country. The United States is a union of independent sovereign states. States in the sense that they were countries. So the United States, when it was established, was kind of like an alliance. You know, we talked about that already under the Articles of Confederation. Citizenship was determined by the states. So, if you tried coming into Massachusetts, Massachusetts had on its books laws that determined, and we covered this, who essentially could become a freeman, who could become not just a legal resident, but a full citizen in Massachusetts. Every single state had slightly different laws. So every single state determined who were their citizens. The United States government, all the way up until passage of the 14th Amendment, recognized that it's the states that determine citizenship. Now, FYI, if you ever read or learned about what today is regarded as a controversial Supreme Court decision, although if you could take modern perspective and modern politics out of it, it actually is not controversial, but Dred Scott v. Sanford. Back in 1857, before the Civil War, the U.S. Supreme Court denied freedom to a slave who, for a short period of time, was brought into a free state. The Supreme Court ruled, and again, correctly, based on the law at the time, that your status is not determined by where you go. Your status is determined where you're from and where you live. So the fact that Dred Scott was a slave, he was brought to Wisconsin when his master was serving in the army, was there for 2 years. The moment he went into Wisconsin, where slavery was barred, that didn't mean he was free. That was the basis of his argument. once free, forever free. No, the Supreme Court said no. His status is determined by his home state, which was Missouri, which was a slave state. Because that's the way the United States system worked. That, however, and by the way, that was the sole reason for the 14th Amendment. Because the only way to overturn a Supreme Court decision is either to have the court change its mind or you amend the Constitution. That's the whole reason why they passed the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment created what today we refer to as United States citizenship. And that's the whole contention over the case that was heard last week over birthright citizenship. That clause was put in the U.S. Constitution to overturn Dred Scott. Because the Supreme Court said the law of the land was, in Dred Scott, you are what your home state says you are. Well, the 14th Amendment says no. It doesn't matter where you were born in the United States. Everyone is the same. Everyone has United States citizenship. Well, why do courts still hear diversity of citizenship cases? Well, it goes all the way back to the origins of our country. You are a United States citizen, but you are a resident of the state in which you reside. So what happens if you have a dispute with someone who lives in another state? Well, if you are a resident in Massachusetts, and you have a claim against somebody who lives in Florida, if you try having a case in Massachusetts, the resident of Florida might not get justice. They might suffer hardship. How are they going to afford the time they have to come all the way up to Massachusetts to have a case heard here? And then the Massachusetts jury might be biased. Because maybe they're going to naturally side with somebody who's one of their neighbors, as opposed to someone from a foreign state. Of course, today it's not as contentious as it once was. But, just FYI, when this Constitution was made, the U.S. Constitution, some of the states actually had undeclared wars against one another. I mean, there's a lot of contention. So the framers put this in and basically said, if you are residents of different states, a good venue where you can get justice is the neutral court, a federal court. Now today, the standards have been changed a little bit. Originally, you could get into a federal court if you had a civil claim. Because, by the way, criminal, they're federal questions. Civil, when you're going to sue someone for money, that's diversity of citizenship. Originally, if you had a claim against someone from another state of anything more than $20, you could get into the federal court system. But today, under current U.S. law, it's $75,000. So diversity of citizenship. Residents of two different states with a claim over $75,000. That's diversity of citizenship. The proper venue would be federal courts. Questions? All right. Jurisdiction of state courts. Well, state courts are common law courts. In the federal court system, the law, criminal law, civil law, that's all been created by statute. All of the potential issues that could get you in a federal court system, it's all part of the U.S. Code. The states, however, have adopted the common law rules that we inherited from England. That, for the bulk of you, I talked about last class.
This means they have the authority to apply and interpret the law, and also have the ability to create law. So they still adhere to stare decisis.
Now, what types of cases could be heard in a state court?
And again, by the way, this applies to all states. I don't know why it went to... Sorry, I'm just going to click ahead. All right, it's missing. It's missing.
Types of cases. State questions. One of the biggest areas of cases that states hear are state questions. So what's a state question? Well, anything dealing with the state constitution or state law. They also can hear common law issues. Common law. Issues like assault, battery, false imprisonment, conversion. You know, those are all common law rules. But they also have concurrent jurisdiction. Concurrent means at the same time. At the same time. They overlap to a degree. So think about the marathon bomber example. I already gave you a concurrent situation. You do an act, and the federal law could apply or the state law could apply. You also could have an issue involving constitutional liberties. As we know, in part of the first, the Declarations of Rights of Citizens in Massachusetts, you have the right to engage in free speech. So the government of Massachusetts cannot stop you from speaking. Well, guess what? That's also in the U.S. Constitution.
Well, if you are suing a state agency, claiming the state agency violated your First Amendment rights, you're also making the claim against Article 14? 13 or 14? I can't remember exactly where the free speech clause is.
Well, maybe it's not convenient for you to go to a federal court, so you're going to actually file in a Massachusetts court. And the Massachusetts court will acknowledge both the Massachusetts issue and the federal issue. The interesting scenario, we'll talk about that next class, is that if it is a federal question that's in concurrent jurisdiction, you would have the ability to appeal not only all the way up to the SJC in Massachusetts, but because it's a U.S. issue as well, you might have the ability to appeal and get into the federal courts. And of course, Massachusetts is also allowed to hear diversity cases. Diversity cases. So maybe you are getting involved in a lawsuit with someone from Rhode Island, but it's less than $75,000. Well, you would file your claim in Massachusetts, if that's most convenient for you or the client.
All right, questions? Right. Oh, shit, it's right. All right. We got 2 minutes left. I'm not going to squeeze time. Didn't have a chance to do the homework. There's only 6 questions. We will take care of that on Tuesday. Can you see your tests? Shut up. You still can't see your tests.
did I do? I opened it up. I found what the issue was. Someone didn't take the test, so I had to give them a zero. I don't even know who the person is, to be honest with you. I think they came like the first day. What?
I couldn't do the second
test.
I couldn't see it.
No. Oh, so there you go. There's the person who got the zero. All right. It's not viewable, though?
No, I don't know. Like, because even when I went to take it, like, you had to go under the exam section. Like,
yeah, it's in the exam section.
Yeah,
right.
But it's, like, not on there. Like, this is the only thing I've done.
All right. Try again for the 10th time.
I think there's a thing, because I know some teachers, like, it says, like, view to all students that you can click. Sometimes it will, like, turn it off.
I clicked everything. I thought I did it right, and I posted the grades and everything. What?
Do you put the homework in there, too? Because
no.
I only see a grade for, like,
the first exam. I don't see, like, homework. No. The homework, remember, the homework was your essay question in lieu of your essay question. So the people who submitted the homeworks, you know, I counted that. And I didn't grade the homeworks, per se. One of the students, I gave them full credit in the essay because they submitted it, but half the answers were wrong. So if you tried it, that's what I did for that last exam. So, all right, I'm going to be on the train for the next 4 hours because I'm going down to New York City, so see if I can figure out what the hell I did. The only thing that you have to be mindful of, obviously, if you haven't done those 6 questions for the judicial section, and this is the deadline on Friday for early submission for your papers. One student has submitted it. They're going to get the extra credit points. If you're almost done or done, you still have time to drop it in. But before you drop it in, make sure you go to proflamanic.com and check again for the 100th time the criteria, all of the grading requirements for the paper. Because it's possible, even if you are an awesome writer, if you don't follow the directions, you could fail the paper. All right? Have a wonderful weekend. I think it might be short weather by the time we see each other next. They were saying it's going to be like 75, almost 80 next week.